This is Tom O'Connell, and I'm talking about Emily Dickinson in our first session, talking about nature, and we'll be talking about some of her nature poems today and tomorrow, and then the next day we'll talk about some of her poems on death, some of her poems the following day about love, and the final day on Friday we'll talk about some of her poems about immortality. The order is somewhat arbitrary, and I devoted 2 days in the general schedule which I sent to Elmer Witt on nature, more because I just wanted to have us talk a bit today, before we get to the nature poem specifically, about Emily Dickinson and her life and what kind of a person she was. Maybe we could get... Why don't you come on right around here? This is a seat I've reserved for you right over here. Or there, either one, but I hope everybody will be able to participate and see. How much do folks know about Emily Dickinson? Somebody want to sort of start it off talking a little bit about her and how much you might know about her? She was a woman poet, I think we all know that. What else do people know by way of background about Emily Dickinson?
She was never married, was she?
She was never married.
Kind of reclusive, as I recall.
Yes, indeed. Quite right. Anything else that people bring by way of background?
Never left New England, did she?
She went one time to Washington, D.C. to visit her father when he was a congressman. That's the only time, and just one time, so you're right. Certainly the essence. The essence is right. Indeed, she spent almost her entire life right in Amherst, Massachusetts, in the Connecticut Valley. She made one trip to Boston to visit an MD for problems she had with her eyes, and most of the rest of the time was spent right at home or very near her home in Amherst to visit relatives and friends. She went down to Hadley, Massachusetts, very close to Amherst, to school. After she finished at Amherst Academy, she went 1 year to the institution that is now Mount Holyoke College. It was then a good institution, not quite at the higher educational level as we now call it, but pretty close. So she was a New Englander, and she was a person who spent all her time right there in that town. And toward the end of her life, she became more and more reclusive, as was suggested. And indeed, at the very end of her life, she was a complete recluse and did not leave home, did not receive guests, did not see anybody except her family. Her family was her world to her. Her family and her poetry. She had a brother who was very close to her. He was older than she was. They were like-minded people. They got along very well, always. As a girl, she was very close to him. He was bright, fun, the way she was growing up, and throughout his whole life, and her whole life as well, they were they were very, very close. She had also a sister a bit younger, 2 years younger than she was, named Lavinia. And Lavinia was also very close to her, but not at all on the same wavelength. She wasn't as bright as her two siblings. She was a very practical, down-to-earth person. And it was good that there was one of them who was that practical after they lost their parents, because she sort of ran the household. She outlived them both, Lavinia did, and indeed it was she who, at the very end of her life, at the very end of Emily Dickinson's life, when Emily passed on, found in Emily's bureau drawer a box which contained just about 900 of Emily Dickinson's poetries. Pull up a chair and make yourself part of the circle or the second row, as you wish. We're being quite informal here. Emily Dickinson had not been known, even to those siblings to whom she was so close, as a poet, as a serious poet. Well, she sent little poems with gifts And one of those I'd like to share with you. Let me just read one of them before I pass these out. I had some poems reproduced to pass out, but I'd like to read you one poem that she sent along with a present. By chivalries as tiny, a blossom or a book, the seeds of smiles are planted, which blossom in the dark. A nice little poem to send with a present. I mean, I would like to get a present that somebody wrote a poem with that much sparkle. Let me read it again. By chivalries as tiny, implied, you see, is by chivalries as tiny as this little gift which I'm giving to you, a blossom or a book, the seeds of smiles are planted that blossom in the dark. So it isn't the gift itself, it's the act of giving, and the future legacy of the charity remembered, the remembrance recalled in tranquility, that is the fun. She was casual about these kinds of poems, and increasingly in her later letters, she would send more serious little lines. But even so, nobody thought she was a serious poet. And so one of the things about her that is kind of fundamental is the degree to which she was extremely private, for the most part, about her writing. She was, though, like a moth around a light bulb about getting her poetry published. As a young poet, in the very early 1860s, for example, when she was at her flood tide of poetry, and 1862 is really the year where she just was bursting with poems, her most creative year, she did sense how good she was. She knew she was darn good, and she wanted to have her poetry published. But the problem she found was when she did have her couple of her poems published by the nearby Springfield, Massachusetts newspaper, they changed some of the words. Well, now to a poet, that's like the teacher redressing the child sent to school in costumes that the teacher thinks is better and sending the child home with completely different clothes on. And you can imagine how a mother would feel about that. Why is this teacher assuming, arrogating to herself this authority to change the clothing of my child? So she was very, very upset when people would change her poetry, and yet, in their defense, her poetry was different, it was hard to understand for them, it didn't have an orderly rhyme scheme, it was abstruse, it was not very accessible. People couldn't just read it and say, this little poem you could. Even that, though, has a conciseness. It's so packed, so chock full, that even that little poem, you have to kind of think a minute about some of the words that she's left out. She wrote another one that I want to share, and let me pass this around so that we can... Got some handouts here for you. But ask you to just pass them around, if you would. And there is one other thing that I want to pass around to you also, which is this thing I came upon. Well, we'll have to share this. But I came upon this handout, which I gave to a class of mine. I was going through my material. I came through this that I taught to a class of mine in 1975. Would you believe? But I thought, boy, this is pretty good for people who are kind of coming to her poetry for the first time. So maybe you three folks would share this one. And you might share this. You might share this one. Let's see how far we can go here. You two share that. I didn't run off anymore because I wasn't sure I was going to do this. But the more I thought about it, the better I liked it. You three can look at that one. You three can share this one. So the poem that I'd like to have us look at and then examine a little bit from the standpoint of this questionnaire is on page 2 of the handout, poem number 26. Annie, would you read that for me?
Sure.
It's all I have to bring today, is the first line. I'm doing here what Annie always does to me. I'm just telling her to do this. We haven't set this up at all, but I'm just keeping her on her toes.
It's all I have to bring today. This and my heart beside. This and my heart and all the fields and all the meadows wide. Be sure you count. Should I forget someone the sun could tell? This and my heart and all the bees which in the clover dwell.
Okay, let's take a look at the questions about this. Notice that this series, when you see a poem like this, that's just a tad difficult to figure out exactly what it is that we're getting at here. This series of questions helps us to analyze it. It's like any puzzle. You really have to kind of take it apart in order to analyze it piece by piece. So let's look at the questions. The first question is, who is the speaker and what kind of a person is he or she, we should add? What impressions do you get of the person who is writing this poem? Someone in love? Someone certainly devoted to the recipient, probably in love, probably, I get the impression, see if you agree with this, probably in love with life. This is a person who seems to me to be in love with life. Anything else about the person? Just the hunch, just the way you feel about it. There are no internal clues necessarily.
It seemed like she would be an outdoors person.
Good, yeah. The references are
and
all...
And she was sharing with her feeling for outdoors.
Yeah, very good, very good. Okay, do you think it's a young person or a more senior person?
More senior.
More senior. Do we agree with that?
No, I think it's young.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a young person.
Mm-hmm. How do the rest of us feel?
I don't see a clue to age.
There seems to me to be about it, and this is very personal. A lot of this is personal. You can call it one way or the other. There's no right answer to these questions. There's a kind of a bullience about it, a kind of a bounce about it, in the spirit of it, that is to say, that suggests to me a younger person, but I'm not sure about that one. To whom is he or she speaking? What kind of person is the recipient? What do we feel about that person? First, the direct question, to whom is the poet speaking?
Possibly a friend.
A dear friend, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say a dear friend?
Mm-hmm.
But to be more specific, we could say the object of the recipient of the gift, the person who is the object of his or her affection.
Mm-hmm.
We might have said, by the way, in answer to number one, that the person who is the speaker is a poet, because it's a poem.
Right.
Might have said that. That's the kind of thing you can kind of work your way through. It's a poet. It's a person who is in love, perhaps, certainly in love, seems to be in love with life. To whom is he speaking? Well, he's speaking to the recipient of the gift, the object of the affection, perhaps a friend, perhaps a lover. What's the occasion of the poem?
A gift, it appears.
A gift, right.
The giving of a gift.
The presentation of a gift, right. The giving of the gift. So it would be, in effect, like the poem below it, which I had read to you earlier, it would be a little note accompanying the gift, and perhaps it would not be signed. If it were Emily Dickinson, she would not necessarily sign it. If she did sign it, it would probably be E.D. or E. Dickinson. It wouldn't be Emily, typically. But she probably wouldn't sign it. Everybody would know who it was, right? Who else writes a poem like this to send with a gift that we know here in Amherst? I think it's probably Emily Dick, as she was sometimes called. Okay, what is the setting in time? What is the time of day, the season, etc.?
It has to be summer, because of clover.
Yeah, it's summer, and she's calling up the metaphors of summer, and therefore we associate it with summer. Conceivably, it could be another time of year, then she could be recalling those, but that's a stretch, and so I think we could reasonably say it's summertime. Okay, number five, the setting in place. I'm not sure we're giving them any clues. Unless somebody sees some, I'm not sure we're given any specific clues about that. You can't always answer all of these questions, but trying to puzzle them through helps you to get to the bottom of the poem. How about number six? What's the central purpose of the poem? Nothing subtle.
To show her love.
To show her love and affection in sending the gift. Just right. Okay, somebody want to try to state the central idea or the theme of the poem in a sentence?
I stumbled on the line. Maybe you can help. Should I forget someone? The some could
some could tell,
yes,
right.
Some could tell, which I misread as son. But I still don't understand what it means.
What do we think about that? Does anybody else have an idea? Someone, the some could tell.
How much she loves if they counted all the fields and the bees.
Yeah. An attempt. It's. I think it's semi-kidding here. It's kind of like, how do I love thee? Let me count the ways. And then you list all the things you can think about. She is saying, we could count how much I love you, but we would have to include all these things that I'm listing, and probably some others as well, because some of them are used kind of inclusively. So, should I forget, be sure you count all the things that I'm giving you here, because I may forget, but someone the sum could tell, we want to have it, see,
so
if you count, then someone could tell all the ways I love you. So it's kind of all the things that I'm willing to give to you to demonstrate my affection for you. Okay? So with that information, which helps perhaps a tad, could somebody want to give us a brief summary of it in a sentence?
This is my gift I give to you. This is my heart beside.
Okay. This is my heart beside. Good. Then there might be just a kind of an extra phrase added to that.
It's kind of like, and this glorious day, and all of nature is yours too.
Yeah. Let me try this on you and see. I worked my way through this to see how I would answer it. And I said, I give you this gift, but I'd give you anything I have. And what I have, essentially, and I'm not a person who's got a lot of money or anything else, and she didn't, but I'll tell you what I do have. I've got a meadow, and I've got beautiful fields, and I've got a whole bunch of bees out in my back area. Bees and clover, the buzzing and the pleasantness. I wondered when I read it if there might be a little in there. I'll send you the bees too. And they are a mixed blessing, but that's the way life is. I'm going to give you everything. Don't expect, though, that what I give you might not possibly cause you trouble. I mean, if I'm going to give you meadows, you're going to have to mow the hay. And I love the buzzing of bees because it suggests summer and nice seasons, but they do sting. Just a thought on my part, she often has these other little levels of meaning. Well, that's one way we can approach some of these poems, if you're intrigued by it, by putting these questions too. Let's finish it up with number eight. Discuss the tone of the poem. What is the tone that you get as you think of the poem? How would you describe the mood?
You used the word ebullience, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The exuberance, the joy, and the...
Good, good. What else?
It's a giving poem.
Yes, very giving. Good. Very good. Anything else?
It's got a lilt to it.
It does. It does. It's almost like a song, isn't it? This poetry is very close to song. Right. I think those are good comments. I think also we might say it suggests to me so full of love. There's so much love, which so often goes with giving. It ought to go with giving. Good. Okay.
It's almost as if it were said to a child, it seems to me. I'm not quite sure why. It's probably the be sure you count. I mean, that's kind of an adult to a child. And maybe... And the imagery is very simple. It's mm-hmm. something that any child mm-hmm. would know. And maybe there's something about the bees, which is also something you would say to a child.
I'll send you the bees, but be careful.
Yeah,
I think it may have done. I don't know that we know to whom it was sent. I don't think so. I don't have any memory that we know to whom it was sent. And there are a whole lot of poems like this. This is one of our favorite occasions for giving poems, so that people did have these poems. And later on, after she died, when people were interested in publishing their poems, they canvassed her friends and got back from her friends many of these kinds of poems that Emily Dickinson had perhaps not kept a copy of. She just sent it off in a letter. Her letter she crafted as carefully as she did her poems, that were more for her own artistic purpose. This was more to send to somebody, and it wanted to be considerate and thoughtful and giving, as you very well said. The person then, if you got a poem like this, would you throw it away? I don't think I ever would. I mean, I'd say, this is something really that I want to keep, particularly if the affection were returned. And therefore, this flood of poems came from all her friends. So it turned out that people knew she wrote more poetry, but no one person knew, because she'd send the poem off to all of you. Let's say you were all her friends. Each of you would have received perhaps two or three or maybe five notes, all with little poems of this sort. So when a couple of her associates and friends started to publish her poems and put out a call for them, they got all back, all these wonderful little gift-style poems. Nobody knew she wrote, except the recipient. If she wrote this to you, nobody'd know that it was sent to you, because it was private, it was between her and you. Now we can all share it, because it's published. Okay, I'd like to have us... We will be talking each day about her nature poetry. And by the way, I do want to be sure that everybody feels perfectly comfortable coming in with questions at any point about her, because there's so much to be said about her. As I said the other night, she is, to me, the most fascinating person in American history. I just find her absolutely fascinating as a person. Partially that's, of course, because I think she's our best poet. She's America's best poet, without any question, in my own view. And the competition would be Walt Whitman, who was writing at the same time, who was very, very different from her. But in some ways, they had similarities as well. But let's take a look at a couple of the other poems that related to nature. Let's move into some of the nature ones. This is quasi-nature. Let's take a look at the one that you read the other night, Annie. Read the whole thing, would you, this time? On page 2, let's see. Yeah, page 6. Page 6. A bird came down the walk.
We did the first part the other night as part of Emily Dickinson's humor.
Now I want to do the whole thing.
Now we get the zinger at the end. A bird came down the walk, he did not know I see. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll start again. A bird came down the walk he did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass, and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet hand like one in danger, cautious. I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rode him softer home. Then oars divide the ocean, two sliver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap flashless as they swim.
Okay.
I misread one word. Yeah, the third verse. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head.
Okay. What kind of bird do you think this is? Has any bird image come to your mind?
Robin.
Robin. Yeah. That's what most people say, and I agree. That just somehow suggests a robin, everything about it. The way he's moving along, the way he handles that worm. What a vivid metaphor, huh? And bit an angled worm in halves and ate the fellow raw. How else do you eat a worm other than raw? Then notice the word play in the next two lines. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass. Why does he use grass? Yeah, but why that particular, what are you going to say?
Well, that's where dew is on
the grass. Yeah.
Early bird gets the worm.
Yeah. Is there another reason for choosing the particular word grass?
It sounds like glass.
Yeah, another one?
It's like glass.
Just like glass. What do you drink from? Usually you drink from a glass, right? Yeah. He's drinking from a grass. So there's a kind of a play on words there. He drank from a grass. Annie mentioned that we had read the first two verses the other night when we were concentrating on humor. Why do you think I really opted for reading that couple of verses up front, the top two, and then not the last three? Notice a change in mood?
Yeah, the last three aren't funny, really. They're...
What are they? What's the mood of them, would you say?
He's afraid.
Yeah. Bird is afraid, isn't he? It's the world in which the bird lives that's being described as a fearful world. Bird has to be afraid, has to be alert all the time. Or some predator gets him or her. There was, by the way, only one continuing fight between Emily Dickinson and her sister Lavinia, who got along famously, but Lavinia liked cats. Emily liked birds. And for 5 decades they fought the battle of birds versus cats. Not an unusual kind of conflict.
Some of you may recall Adlai Stevenson said was unsoluble. The war between cats and birds could not be resolved.
No way. No way can solve that.
Even the United Nations.
Notice, with respect to that change in mood, to the more serious description of the bird in the three last verses describing the fearful world in which the bird lives. You notice any change? You just take a look at the technical aspect of it, and we won't spend a lot of time with that, but take a look at the difference in the rhyme pattern. Can you see any difference there? If there is a rhyme, it's what we might call slant rhyme. Rhyme, that is, which is not absolutely rhyming, but suggests the same sound. So, in the second and fourth lines of the first two verses, we have saw and raw. And in the second verse, we have grass and pass. In the third verse, what we have in lines 2 and 4 are around and head. not really very close rhyming, what we call slant rhyme. The same general sound, but not exactly rhyming. In the fourth verse, we have crumb and home. A little closer, but still not direct rhyming. And in the fifth verse, we have seam and swim, which again are slant rhyme. They suggest, they call our attention to a difference in mood. We take a look, we wonder why we've got the mood. Notice the way Annie read it, it's kind of automatic. You read the first two with a kind of sing-song. Indeed, I've sometimes read those verses to students with a very sing-song. And you see how it lends itself to this. A bird came down the walk, he did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass, and then he hopped sidewise, and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. See how it lends itself to that? Boy, you can't do that with the third verse, or the fourth verse, or the fifth verse. Those are much different in mood. If you started to do that, you'd be tripped up right away as you tried to get the rhyme for the fourth line. It just doesn't lend itself to that. That's not the tone, the flavor, the feeling we get from the poem is quite different from the first two, and that rhyme scheme is one of the things that gives us that clue. Okay, let's read what we might call the title poem. Actually, I think that I didn't give you this one. I didn't. This handout, by the way, is rather like this question, series of questions. I came upon this, too, when I was coming up, getting ready to come up here. It was a list of poems that I read back in 75. I started teaching Dickinson, I realized this. Another thing I realized, just 20 years ago, started in 1966 teaching her, and Annie and I lived at this is my wife Annie O'Connell, I think everybody knows her, but maybe not. She and I lived at that time about 30 miles as the crow flies from Emily Dickinson's home in Amherst, Massachusetts. So I've been to her home many times. And indeed, this past June, Annie and I were back east, and we went to visit her home again, because at that point, I knew I was going to be teaching her up here, and I just wanted to rub up against that atmosphere one more time. And Annie was then preparing to direct Belle of Amherst, which is presently being performed in Seattle and outside Seattle. I guess it's closed now. The summer run was at the Snoqualmie Falls Forest Theater. Any of you from Seattle? Some folks from Seattle, so you might know where that theater is. And the performance of Belle of Amherst will be given in several spots around Seattle over this coming fall. Belle of Amherst is a very good play by a man named William Luce, which tells, it's a one-person play, performed, by the way, by Ruth McCree Schultz. Do any of you know Ruth? Ruth performed it here at Holden Village. She's married to a Lutheran minister. She's a professional actress. She and Annie have done work together. And she was the one who introduced us to Elmer Witt and is, in effect, the midwife to our marriage with Holden Village, if I could put it that way. Is that right? Midwife to the birth of this association? So you think metaphors are easy? See the way she handles metaphors? They're not necessarily that easy. You see how I stumble trying to get one right?
The yenta to this marriage.
The yenta to this marriage. Very good. Use a Hebrew.
Matchmaker.
Okay. And Ruth is playing Emily Dickinson in this one-person play, which takes her through her life and which uses a number of her poems to describe her situation. It's beautifully integrated and with impeccable scholarship. If you get a chance to see the play or get to see it on television, Julie Harris did it for television and it's been shown a number of times, and it's a beautifully done production on television also. I've seen it several times. I can't resist it every time it comes on. I
also
want to watch it.
In Seattle, the public library has a 16-millimeter film. called A Certain Slant of Light, which is about her house and about Amherst. Parts of it are very good. Parts of it are really funny. But they sort of play act some stuff that doesn't have anything to do with Emily Dickinson. But you do get to see the town and the house and the, you know, her clothes and the room that she wrote in, and that's very nice.
By the way, I want to recommend for those of you who will be with us this week and are interested in Emily Dickinson, this book, Final Harvest, which is a very good collection of her poems. Why don't I pass it around? Take a look at it, which is available in the bookstore. I suggested that they order it, so there are some copies in the bookstore if you'd like to pick it up there. It's as good a collection of her poems, short of the complete collection of all of her 1,775 poems, that I know, actually put together by the man, Thomas Johnson, who put together the authoritative version of her 1,775 poems. This is the complete poems. So if you get as taken as I am with her, then you'll graduate from Final Harvest and you'll have to have the complete poems. But short of that, this book gives you an awfully good look at her variety, and many of her best poems are in there, if not most. I have an earlier version of that book, which has got all of my notes in it from time to time that I've used, so I am going to read to you from it, but it has the same page. Those of you who have the book can follow along. Those of you who don't have the book, I'll read it to you. And by the way, I haven't necessarily wanted you to have before you every single poem that I read, because it's that I read and that I'm going to be sharing with you, partially because the experience of hearing the poem without seeing it is a different experience from the experience of listening and reading at the same time. They're kind of different, and they both should be savored. I'm a believer in reading poetry aloud. I think the art of reading poetry aloud, reading aloud generally, but especially poetry, is something that we are losing to our real detriment. And I think particularly reading to children is something that we should all do more of when we get the chance. And a poet particularly writes to be read aloud. Those of you who've written poetry, and I shouldn't wonder some of you have, would want to have your poetry read aloud. Has anybody worked on poetry, writing any poetry? Don't. I'm not going to hold you to sharing it with us necessarily, but I just wonder, has anybody fooled around with writing some poetry? It's hard. It's very hard. I've tried it, and I find I don't have the gift. I like to write, but I only wrote one poem that I really thought was much good, and I just didn't have the inspiration to do it. I'm not a person who has a lot of imagination. When I tried to write and have put two people at a table in a restaurant, I can't even make a waiter come up. That's my problem. I just can't imagine how it works. It's a special gift that I don't have. I don't have that knack. But so I want to share some poems with you that you will not have before you, although we'll do a good bit of work on this handout that I've given you, so you may retain those if you'd like to do so. This is a poem that I'd like to read for you twice, and then let's just see what you might get out of it. So you'll be hearing it without having it in front of you, unless you have the book, and then of course I'd be glad to have you look at it. These are the days when the birds come back. A very few, a bird or two, to take a backward look. These are the days when skies resume the old, old sophistries of June, a blue and gold mistake. O fraud that cannot cheat the bee, almost thy plausibility induces my belief. Till ranks of seeds their witness bear, and softly through the altered air hurries a timid leaf. I'll read it one more time. See if you can get the time of year, what she's talking about here. These are the days when birds come back, a very few, a bird or two, to take a backward look. These are the days when skies resume the old, old sophistries of June, a blue and gold mistake. O fraud that cannot cheat the bee, almost thy plausibility induces my belief, till ranks of seeds their witness bear, and softly through the altered air hum hurries a timid leaf. What time of year is it? Indian summer. I think it's Indian summer. It's spring. This is a good guess because they've got the wind whirling around in March, etc.
But
there are some clues.
For a backward look.
Okay. What is the fraud she refers to? Oh, fraud that cannot cheat the bee.
Well, Indian summer, you had a cold spell, and then you have a warm spell again.
Right. But it's not really summer.
No, it's not.
And it's not going to last.
Yeah. But it fools you.
And the bees know. The bees are doing, they're doing something that they don't do in the summer.
Yep.
I think they go into their hives. I don't know about bees.
They get one last bloom.
Suck of honey.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That flower. There's
no flowers. But there are no flowers. I don't think the bees are out in Indian summer.
Just a few might be around, but their activity wouldn't be the same.
Cannot cheat the bee.
Cannot cheat the bee, right. Oh, fraud that cannot cheat the bee. Well, is there you use the word Indian summer, several of you, to describe this, and that's the usual term. Can you think of an association with that phrase that suggests fraud, another one? Is there kind of play on words here with Indian summer? She doesn't state the words, but is there an implication there? What other phrase do we use, like we use Indian summer?
Indian giver.
Mm-hmm. Indian giver. The Lord, or whoever makes these, is an Indian giver. He gives us summer again, and then he takes it right back. Right? Any?
There's another phrase for Indian summer too, but I don't know what it is. And I can't remember.
You're not thinking of squall winter.
Maybe.
We had squall winter, and then we had Indian summer.
So what's squall winter?
Well, there's a cold snap.
That's the cold snap.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
What do you call it in the wintertime when robins come back and eat all little apples off the crab trees? We had it at our house. They were so pretty in February. They were sitting there eating them crazy little brown apples, and they weren't any good. We knew they weren't. Just for about 4 or 5 days, and they were gone until spring. At least 6 weeks, they were gone again.
Sometimes they can get high doing that, too.
Yeah, we never
seen them get high.
We never seen
they
them
bop get around high. Like drunks, and they're just high from the...
No, we didn't notice that.
Yeah, sometimes that'll happen.
They were too dry.
Yeah, maybe they were too dry. Yeah.
They had dried too much in the wintertime.
But there's still nourishment in them, see?
Yes, there was.
There's still nourishment.
Like dried apples.
They were dried apples.
Sure. Yes, indeed.
Dehydrated, frozen.
Is there something about this poem that you nature lovers see as inaccurate, particularly right up front?
Better read it again.
These are the days when birds come back, a very few, a bird or two, and to take a backward look. They don't do that. That's the point. They don't do that, but... We now know they don't because we know a lot more about bird behavior. We're birders, so we know. We'll pass the word on to you. The birds don't go and then come back. But the fact is that when it was cold, they were hunkered down in the woods, or they were going to somebody's feeder but not showing themselves around in general. But the minute that sun comes out, we've noticed that as we've been birding these last few mornings, when the sun comes out, hey, everybody responds, not just us. All of nature responds, including birds particularly. So they start to come out again. So you see, hey, look at those robins. Here they're back. Not back, but they were hunkered down under a bush when it was cold, thinking about, boy, I guess it's maybe time we headed south. But then the sun comes out again and they say, wow, let's stick around for a while. So they are visible to us again. So in Emily Dickinson's time, it was generally thought that indeed, in Indian summertime, the bird said, oh, hey, it's still going to be nice back there. Let's go back. There's no scientific basis for it whatsoever.
It occurs most every year. The February thing doesn't occur every year.
Yeah. Right, right. True, true. Okay.
Well, those are also birds which have wintered over
the blue jays.
Without moving.
The blue jays do.
Yeah.
More and more birds are sticking around as more of us feed them. As more and more of us feed them. Annie, would you read for us, as you did the other night, the letter poem? I think that's kind of a fun one that I don't want to forget to ask you to read. It is on page 6, the top poem.
Oh, yeah. Great. I'd like to say that Ruth McCree Schultz and I worked this spring on a radio program that we did with some musicians, and we did 7 poems of Emily Dickinson's and music, and it was played on the 100th anniversary of her death on the Seattle KUOW radio station and also on the Amherst WFCR radio station. So that was kind of fun. And Ruth included this poem in that radio program.
B, I'm expecting you, was saying yesterday to somebody you know that you were due. The frogs got home last week, are settled and at work. Birds mostly back, the clover warm and thick. You'll get my letter by the 17th. Reply. Or better, be with me. Yours, Fly.
Now that's one that's quite accessible, isn't it? We can access it quite easily because it's right there for us. And there are a number of them that are like that, that you don't really need to puzzle about a great deal. Here is one on page 7 at the top, which might take a little more puzzling. This is a medium difficult one, I would say, in the sense that it's worth a little bit of analysis, but I think on our first reading you will be able to perceive what it is that's happening here. Why don't I read this one? Bloom is result. To meet a flower and casually glance would scarcely cause one to suspect the minor circumstance assisting in the bright affair, so intricately done, then offered as a butterfly to the meridian. To pack the bud, oppose the worm, obtain its right of dew, adjust the heat, elude the wind, escape the prowling bee, great nature not to disappoint, awaiting her that day. To be a flower is profound responsibility. Questions or comments about it? How about the first 3 words? Is that clear? Bloom is result. What's it the result of?
Growth.
Yep. What else would the poet be saying here that it is the result of? That it means to say bloom is result.
To reproduce.
Bud?
Yeah, you just got to start with a bud, yeah. Mm-hmm.
To fulfill.
That's creation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. What else is it the result
the
of?
The flower was created for the bee. And to reproduce.
To escape the prowling bee, which may at that particular point not necessarily be performing the germinating function, I think is here implied, escape the prowling bee. So bloom is a result of
all this activity.
Mm. Yeah.
But do you think that's, poetically, do you think that's very good? bloom is a result, it has a hardness to it.
But its concision is, it seems to me, kind of magic. I wish she'd left it, that line alone and let it stand there. Bloom is result. I would say it's the result. It's the result of all the things you said. I'd also say that it's the result of the hard work. All those things are, in her terms, the hard work of that flower. You think this bloom that I'm throwing out just happens, right? Wrong. Listen, give a little credit to that little flower. You know how hard that flower has worked to produce that that bloom?
It's ultimate.
From the bud, from the seed to the bud to the throwing out the leaves, and then let me read it one more time and you'll see how much work has gone into it and how much credit is being given to that creature, that that botanical specimen.
That's what it was created for, to do that.
That's what it was created for. That's the view, let's see, that's a human being's view, having God in mind. But what Emily Dickinson is trying to do is to say, we tend to think of inanimate, of other growing things, and she was, by the way, quite a good botanist. She was a very good botanist. She had a greenhouse. For the winter months, which she grew things, in which she grew things, and she knew them, and she had a garden in the blooming season in Amherst, and was an expert botanist. So she's trying to say, these, well, she'll be right at home now with people who want to talk to your flowers. Talk to those flowers. They are going to be responsive. She is. This might be said to be anthropomorphic or teleological. We're giving human qualities to this, this particular botanical specimen. But Emily Dickinson would say, well, that's a kind of arbitrary way to think about it. Think about what this flower, the plant, has accomplished here. Let me read it one more time and you'll see how hard this flower has worked. Bloom is result. To meet a flower and casually glance would scarcely cause one to suspect the minor circumstance assisting in the bright affair. All these little things that have gone into making this, this creature. So intricately done and then offered as a butterfly to the meridian. What is being referred to? Why do we talk about a butterfly there?
Well, the colors.
The colors, right?
Why is the same meridian?
Why does it say meridian, do you think?
I don't get that until the meridian.
What's a meridian?
A divide.
Dividing.
Yeah.
From one to the other.
Right. Mm-hmm. So.
Does that symbolize the crossroads, sort of, people passing?
Well, no, I don't think we need to. We don't have to look that hard, I don't think. Why butterfly? What is the characteristic of a butterfly in addition to being colorful? Yeah, no, you're giving it to me with your hands.
To flip from one.
Sure, it's moving. Okay, so the flower, at least some petals from the flower, typically, as it ripens completely, go off in the air. Mm-hmm. Where do they go? Hey, I don't know where they go. They are offered to the meridian. They're going to be blowing to the next meridian, right? They're going to be, if we want to measure where they went, we're going to have to measure where they went by the meridian, because they may blow for miles and miles if they get up high enough and get into a prevailing wind from the west, huh? Mm-hmm. They could blow all the way to Spokane from here, right? That's a meridian away.
Well, a butterfly migrates too.
Butterfly migrates too, so it moves too. So she's capturing here. You think of this as a stationary object, that little flower right there. It's okay, but it stays right there. Not so. It moves like a butterfly. Give the flower credit for all this, right? This is hard work to create something that can make like a butterfly.
And does meridian ever mean sun? That's what I thought.
That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah,
the
I
sky.
Think it does.
Yes.
I think it's just being offered up to what's right there.
Let's look it up, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Because I can't. It's ringing bells.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You look at. Anybody wants
bells.
To look it up. Okay. Right, could very well mean that. to pack the bud. Okay, now we list all these things. These are hard work. There's a lot of sweat going into these actions, right? It's like dish duty. To pack the bud, oppose the worm, obtain its right of due, adjust the heat, elude the wind, escape the prowling bee.
Yeah.
And all of this, what is this all for? It's to be sure that you don't disappoint the... what?
The
deity, the Lord, we might say. Emily Dickinson says, great nature. She would not necessarily want to use Mother Nature. That would be a little trite for Emily Dickinson. She'd want to use something fresher. So she says, great nature. But it gives it a deity kind of a quality, such as Mother Nature has. Great nature not to disappoint, awaiting her that day, awaiting the bloom that day. To be a flower, and then she kind of sums it up. Hey, pay attention to this flower. To be a flower is profound responsibility. I've just categorized for you all the things that flower does to throw that bloom out. So I think what she's doing in your objection to that opening where bloom is result is to provoke us. Bloom is result. What does that mean? Well,
it's not what it means, it's the language. It's just so degrading.
How could we say it better?
Bloom is consequence, bloom is fulfillment, bloom is culmination, bloom is the ultimon, if she's after a particular meter, but...
But I think that bloom is resolve, is a summation of what she ends with here. She tells you everything that happens. And then
yeah.
She's saying bloom is resolved.
And she wants it.
And it ties to responsibility.
Yeah.
Result in responsibility.
So you could actually
fit together.
Bloom is resolved and you would have a complete
form. Yeah, right. But I like your point because I think it's well taken. I would say that she does it on purpose. She wants a homely, everyday expression. She wants it, listen, the cleanliness in my kitchen, I might say, doesn't just happen. It's the result of my elbow grease. You want to know what I do in my kitchen to make it clean? I do this and I do that and I sweep and I wash and I wipe. So it's the result. Cleanliness is result. Flower is result. Bloom is result. Bloom is result of all that the flower has done. It's a result in a homely, every day, almost, she often uses these housewifely metaphors, even subtly stated like this one. So I'll look for them, because she uses her own experience. And as I'll talk at Vesper, she uses the Bible, which is her book.
Yeah.
She uses what she has. Her housewifely experience, her love of nature, her experience with death of friends, her experience with love. Unlimited, but she takes it and runs with it and gives us as much as she can. Her experience with her conjectures about immortality and what it means. Okay, we'll continue talking about nature tomorrow, and then we'll introduce some that have to do with love, with death, which will be the next day. And nature poems deal often with the death that goes with creatures, because flowers die, and she feels it. A very sentient person, perhaps the most sentient person I've ever been exposed to. So we'll pick it up tomorrow. Mm-hmm.